Hey y'all, Anita here. One of the best things about being on the 2018 JOCO cruise was getting the chance to sit down on a giant boat and talk to some amazingly creative people. I hope you enjoy listening to these special conversations as much as I loved having them. We're releasing one a week as a special bonus for you amazing listeners. And remember, we do need your help to keep making this podcast, so please consider joining our podcast community for exclusive perks and bonus content at d.rip/femfreak. First up is award-winning, cat-loving, science fiction writer N.K. Jemisin, who is always so thoughtful with her words. And guess what? She's a huge lifelong video game nerd.
Hey, Nora.
Hi.
How's it going?
Pretty good after 7 days at sea. Oh, 6 days at sea.
6 days at sea, yeah, I know. So I keep doing these interviews with people on the ship, and we keep talking about the ship. And so I'm just going to release all these interviews where we're like, we're on a boat. And my listeners are going to be like, we get it. Yeah. You're on a boat. But it's such an integral part of this experience.
It really
that
is.
It's hard to not bring that up. But yeah, so you, many of our fans are mm-hmm. fans of yours. You are quite the writer and the world builder of the science fictions.
Thank you. Yeah. I try to be. Writing is just fun for me. And then when I had my early midlife crisis at 30, I decided to try and see if I could make some money at it. And
Can you back up a little bit and just say, like, how did that happen? How did you become a writer?
I literally have been writing since I was about 8 years old. So there was kind of never a time when I was a thinking human being of complexity and was not writing. But I just did it as a hobby for the longest time, just thinking it's like a cool way to spend time or whatever. And I progressed. Just wrote novels for most of my young adult life. And then, like I said, around 30, I hit a midlife crisis. I was an educator. I was living in Boston. I was cold all the time. I was miserable. And I was just kind of not happy with the way that my life was going at that stage. And I had read a bunch of books that were terrible that I just kind of, you know, I don't want to talk about the specific books, but I read a bunch of books where I was like, I have written stuff that's better than this and I'm not published. And then it finally hit me, maybe I should try and get published. So, So I actually then went to a writing workshop. At that workshop, I started working on actively trying to get an agent, improving my writing skill by learning how to write short stories. And then I got an agent, and that was pretty much the end of that.
Wow. And and so this is full-time. You are now.
It is now full-time.
Yeah.
In mid-2015, I quit my day job. I ran a Patreon campaign that was significantly successful. And because of that, I was able to safely quit my day job. Quit my day job without fear of homelessness.
Yeah.
Which is a thing that not everyone is able to do, luckily.
Yeah,
yeah. And then, of course, my book went bestseller. So, I mean, I hadn't known at the time that that was going to happen.
Sure. I mean, how could you?
Yeah. But I mean, it was a nice confluence of events.
Yeah, so, totally. Yeah. This is interesting. So two does not make a pattern, but we mm-hmm. had talked to Anne Leckie,
mm.
Who does the Ancillary Justice Wretch series, which I love.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
And she also came into writing later mm-hmm. in life. It wasn't her first career. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering, again, it's not a pattern, but I bet you that there are other writers that I've liked who have done that. And to me, it's bringing these voices, like sci-fi and fantasy writers, especially mm-hmm. women and women of color coming into this space, are bringing mm-hmm. perspectives and imagination that mm-hmm. a lot of the mainstream sci-fi mostly male writers
mm-hmm.
haven't been doing. They've just been recreating the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
Well, not all, but to some degree. I have a tendency to only read female authors, not exclusively, but that's just kind of what ends up happening.
Mm-hmm.
And for the longest time, I hated fantasy. I refused.
I don't blame you. I really don't.
Yeah, like up until relatively recently, I would not touch a fantasy book. I would not watch fantasy movies. I wouldn't play fantasy video games. I was like, there's literally nothing about this that's interesting.
Yeah.
The things about science fiction that I find interesting are the vision, right?
Mm-hmm.
The view, the future society, both dystopian or utopian or a combination of the two.
Right.
And fantasy was always just this, like, the same, the Tolkien stuff. I didn't know that fantasy existed outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read mm-hmm. The Steerswoman's Road by Rosemary Kirsten.
Yeah.
And that's one of my favorite
mm-hmm.
novel series.
Yeah, I like this
and
too.
It's a fantasy book. And I was like, I don't understand.
Yeah.
And it was just a completely different perspective on this space, which I realized is so mm-hmm. much more vast than what I had been exposed to.
Right. I mean, I don't like fantasy either. No, it's not just you. Okay, fantasy used to be a lot more diverse and wild and open than it was post-Tolkien. Tolkien and the era of the Tolkien clones in particular in like the 80s or so, 70s and 80s kind of really contracted the market away from its potential. It was potentially a really interesting and imaginative space that did not obsess over medieval Europe and restoring the king to power. The standard stock story.
The boring shit.
Yes. The inherently conservative, yes, boring shit.
Yeah.
It used to be a lot more complex than it was, and then the era of the Tolkien clones kind of killed that. And so we're only just now kind of emerging from this post-Tolkien twilight. I didn't mean to phrase it like that, but that's basically where we are right now. And fantasy is finally starting to remember that it actually can be about things other than the tried and true. That it is actually supposed to be a literature of imagination, and that there's supposed to be some wonder, there's supposed to be some really interesting and wild stuff going on in this field. And it's just, a lot of people have been driven out of it. A lot of readers like you got just basically bored out of their minds during the Tolkien era. I almost got bored out of my mind during the Tolkien era and went off to do other things. A lot of my readers seem to be the people who used to be fantasy fans, got bored, and are finally now looking at it again because they're starting to see that there is actually the possibility of something else out there.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying I'm the lone person doing that. There's a lot of new writers coming out, a lot of new voices who are contributing to this post-Tolkien freedom. It's going to take a while for us to kind of shake off the stigma of that era. And there are a lot of people and a lot of forces actively working to try and retain that stigma, which I don't understand. But a lot of people kind of fighting to keep fantasy as boring and as frustrating as it has been.
Yeah.
Because they were comfortable with it there and they don't like being challenged or whatever.
Which is always interesting, right? Because this is, I mean, that is the conversation that, it's not a conversation. Mm-hmm. That is the like ragey male tears of bullshit that's been happening in games and happening in sci-fi and fantasy
everywhere.
And in comics and literally everywhere.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, it's not like people are going to stop writing those stories.
Yeah.
They're still going to exist. It's just like, how do we have more stories? How do we have like a range of a range of fantasy, right? Like, like legitimately, what are the different levels of imagination that we can bring to this space that is not limited by movie budgets and TV budgets? Like, that's one of the cool things about books is that you can bring these worlds to life. And so why are we doing the same thing over and over again?
Right.
One thing that I feel is like such a treat in sharing, we've been to two conventions together now, or conferences or what have you, where you do these events that are about world building. And you walk through, not events, sorry, these panels that are about world building and character building, and you talk about your process, and you guide the audience through building a world, even if it's made of cats, which is what's on this ship.
Yes, or pizza. I did a world made of pizza once.
Did you?
Yeah, because the kids were hungry after lunch, and so they drew. They drew a continent shaped like a pizza pie. And so
and
it's always an interesting exercise.
Yeah, and you roll with it.
Yeah.
And what I find special about this is, one, it gives us insight into your process. And also, it's fascinating watching you navigate. Like, you're like, you want a world of pizza? Cool. I'm still bringing all of the science to it. Like, the level of research and the level of work and the level of believability that you bring into this, just in watching you navigate, like, well, you couldn't put that there because the current doesn't travel that way, or the wind goes, fuck if I know how science works. But
well, we discovered that the pizza world would be uninhabited because everybody would be dead.
And so one thing I've noticed, especially I've been exposed to so many more sci-fi fantasy writers, especially on this ship, is that like the research you do, like just the intelligence and of enormous different arenas of research and world and science and customs that come into your worlds and the things that you put together.
Well, thank you. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm trying to create worlds that I would be convinced by. You know, the whole purpose of fantasy is to weave a spell, is to spin a what if, a concoction of imagination that you're going to buy into. And, you know, me being a cynical 21st century person who's read a lot of science books or, you know, watched nature enough or whatever, you know, me as my 45-year-old self who's grown up on these things, this is what I need to engage with the what if that a fantasy story is going to throw at me. I need to buy that its people are realistically written. I need to buy that the author at least made a passing attempt to understand the laws of physics. Or if they're consciously altering the laws of physics, I want to know that it's conscious. Mm-hmm. And I want to know, did the author think through all the implications of whatever little change that they're doing? And that makes it work for me. Once I see that the author, once I trust the author, so for me, it's about, this is how you establish trust with your audience. Once the author has established enough trust, enough proof that, yeah, I know what I'm doing, I'm creating a new world, and I understand how worlds work, at least our world, then I'm willing to buy whatever, you know, flying fish, cats, whatever. Whatever they want to throw at me. But I need to know that grounding of, no, you're not just pulling this out of your ass. You're actually thinking it through and giving it some plausibility. So
yeah,
that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And so does that change, like, do you feel like you establish that in like the first book, for example, and then do you have to reestablish that in previous
In a trilogy, well, I mean, it depends on the trilogy. With the Inheritance trilogy that I did, those were three separate stories in the same world, and each of them kind of stood alone. The third one, maybe not so much, with the Broken Earth trilogy, that's one story. It's just broken into three parts. In that one, it was easier to establish a world and then let's see what happens from there. And I didn't have to do as much world building in the second and third book. I did have to do some because I had established as part of the plausibility of the world that all things change in a season. So as the season wore on over the course of the trilogy, I needed to show how the world was adapting and changing as a result. But with the Dreamblood and the Inheritance books, that Dreamblood was almost purely political. There was no physical change to the world at that point. The Inheritance trilogy, there wasn't much physical change, but I was trying to show, you know, societal change on a fairly vast scale.
Do you feel like, are you energized and excited about doing the research, or do you feel like it's kind of a chore?
I'll do research all damn day if it's up to me. The problem, I am a research addict. Okay. I will read books and go on trips and do all these wonderful things as a lovely way to procrastinate on actually writing the damn book.
Got it, yeah.
So research is bad. scratch it. Research is good as long as it is in moderation.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I constantly have to remind myself I am not writing a textbook. I am writing a fantasy novel. It is supposed to be fictional. I have to use my imagination somewhere and not just like spit back all this cool stuff I now know about rocks. No matter how much the research phase gives me permission to geek out over a thing that's interesting to me, I still have to rein it in and then get to work at the end of that.
Yeah, yeah, totally. You're a gamer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Which I think I saw someone, I think Tanya from I Need Diverse Games, either sometimes plays with you or had tweeted about playing games with you or streaming.
Yeah.
And I remember, I don't know why, and I feel like this is one of those things about like who you assume is a gamer and who you don't, because I was like, she's a gamer, that's so cool. As opposed to being like,
I keep getting that. I'm like, what the hell?
As I was thinking about it, I'm like, is really part of the gatekeeping and the unintentional gatekeeping that we, as someone who is very against that, is like, well, why would you sci-fi woman, why would you play games, right?
Because what, 40 something percent of gamers are women?
Yeah, exactly.
Something like that same percentage are people of color, and you know, a vast percentage are over 35, and I fall right into the prime. I am the prime demographic. I am what gamers look like. Damn it.
which I love. I think that's amazing. Yeah. But it is very much something that we have in our brains, and like, I think it's important, and I'm calling myself out on this because I think it's important to remind ourselves constantly about like as much as I would never be like, no, you don't play games, you're faking it. The fact that I was even surprised by it is a part of the problem, I think. Now that I've put that, my own garbage, out of the way, have you played games your whole life? And what kinds of things do you like to play?
I mean, I've played since the My cousin had a Pong unit, and I thought it was yeah. really boring. Sure. So, but I would go over and I would play Pong with them. So I've literally played since Pong.
That's amazing.
But, you know, one of my mom's boyfriends trying to impress me got me an Atari 2600, and, mm-hmm. and it worked. I just left him alone after that. I was like, you can stay. So yes, I have played my whole life. I did go through a period when I was in my like late 20s, 30s, where I just didn't have time. I was too tired all the time, and I didn't really keep up with it. But then I finally got like enough money and need for stress relief at the same time that I got back into it. And so, you know, I now have a PS4 and I was thinking about getting finally an Xbox One just because State of Decay 2 is about to come out. And that's the only game I want on that. That, you know, and it's wrong to buy a console for one game, but I really want to play that game.
That's how they do it. That's how they get you.
That's how they get you. So I'm almost entirely a console gamer because I use Macintoshes otherwise for my writing life. And Macs are terrible game units. You know, I play Civilization on it, but that's about it. But yeah, I game for fun. And I even now have a Twitch channel, thanks to Tanya,
awesome.
For my Need to Diverse Games, who helped get me on Twitch and get me set up with bots and all this other stuff for protection and not minimal stress.
Yeah, that's awesome. Tanya's great. She mm-hmm. helped us a bunch when Feminist mm-hmm. Frequency started Twitch streaming as well.
She knows what she's doing.
It's part of how this community works, right? Yeah. We all just like
looking out for each other.
Mm-hmm. So what are you playing now?
Lately, what have you been interested in? I love games with really kind of interesting narratives.
Are there games with interesting narratives?
There are lots of games. I know that was a gimme question. It had to be a gimme question. You have to know this. Yes, there are really... Nier Automata.
Okay.
Which I'm playing right now, which I've been raving at people about, is possibly one of the most recursive and complex narratives that I've seen in media, not just in gaming. Have you played it?
I haven't.
Okay.
I know. But please continue.
Yeah, it's a little boring in the first playthrough.
Carolyn, who works mm-hmm. with us at Feminist Frequency, did play it and wrote some really thoughtful things on our site, like comparisons mm-hmm. of Nier mm-hmm. and some other games. And it passed over me because I'm not a big fan of that play style. Mm-hmm. But I just, everyone raves about it. I kind of feel like I need to just go back and give it a chance.
The initial impression that you're going to get of that game is, first and foremost, why the fuck is she dressed like that?
Yes, that was actually what put me off at first.
Me too, except that I had played the first Nier, and I knew that Yoko Taro, who is the writer and I think director for that game, I don't know how J games work, but I know that he likes to kind of throw deceptive things at people. And so your initial impression is, why is she dressed like that? And the first kind of playthrough of the game that you're going to do is going to be a lot of boring ass fetch quests. But then once you kind of really get into it, and once you dig a little deeper and sort of understand what exactly is going on with the game, you begin to realize that it's a commentary on the over-sexualization of game characters, of robots, of whatever you want to call it, you know, on how protagonists are typically constructed to be a certain kind of person. And then if they're a female character, they are also sexualized. And then the game continues to play with gender and continues to play with your perceptions of what is actually happening.
Okay.
And I'm like trying to talk about it without spoilers. So that's kind of semi-coherent. But but it gets deeper than it looks.
All right.
There's she's there for eye candy, yes, but there's still more going on with it. So I've been playing that. I've been playing Assassin's Creed Origins, which is not so great on the narrative front, but beautifully done.
Do you like Assassin's Creed games in general?
No.
Okay.
This is the first Assassin's Creed game I've been able to play for more than about 20 minutes.
Okay.
Because the others were just dull. But this one, I was willing to give it more time because it's set in ancient Egypt, and you can tell that they did their research. You can tell that someone on that team went to Egypt, looked around, saw how people were still living today in some ways the very same way that they used to be living thousands of years ago. Not everybody there, but, you know, some. And you can see, like, the detail and the complexity, and it feels very lived.
Mm.
So I've been enjoying the hell out of that. Most recently, I've been replaying Shadow of the Colossus, which got re-released in a remaster, I don't know, which was one of the first games that showed me that games could be art. Because there isn't really so much of a narrative there. In fact, there's the absolute lack of a narrative. You're given a scenario, and then there's no explanation as to how that scenario came about. And then you see the result of a fateful choice that the protagonist makes.
Yeah.
And it's just beautifully done from there.
Yeah. So everyone I know loves that game.
And I'm about to hear a butt here, huh?
Yeah. Well, okay. You know, so Shadow and Ico are two very, very beloved games. Mm-hmm. And they're not good for women at all.
Yeah.
And for me, something like Ico, for example, or Ico, however one chooses to pronounce it, I can't get past the fact that the core mechanic in this game
is rescue the damsel.
Yes,
yeah.
In the most patronizing, awful way. And so with Shadow, I think I struggled with... So there is the narrative at the end with the...
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I'm not worried about spoiling Shadow Colossus. Sorry, y'all.
It's been out for a long time. Statute of limitations is gone.
Yeah, there's got to be a limit at some point for spoilers.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's the bit at the end with the woman and the woman refrigerator kind of thing that's happening. Mm. But so also I think that what people really resonated with that game about, one, it's a beautiful, it's a beautiful world kind of thing. But, you know, you're killing these beasts and you slowly realize that you shouldn't, that you're the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's because I didn't play it when it came out, but that kind of narrative sits wrong with me because I don't feel like... I feel like games in particular as a medium are really bad at you're doing this bad thing and you should feel bad for doing it, but keep doing it or else you would stop playing the game.
I do think Shadow of the Colossus, you notice I didn't mention Ico. I've played Ico. I have the same reaction to it. It's a great puzzle game. On the other hand, the mechanic of, you know, constantly rescuing Yorta and Yorta being a contrivance in every way. She literally isn't human, but she also doesn't do anything that makes sense.
Yeah.
So she gets herself constantly into trouble, and you constantly have to solve that problem. She is the problem. I'm not a fan of Ico. I am much, much more of a fan of Shadow of the Colossus, which to me feels like a reversal of the refrigerator trope. So she's been fridged. We don't know why. We don't need to know why at the end of the day. The point is that she's important to this character in and of herself, and he wants to bring her back to life, and he's willing to go through this in order to do so. Then she becomes important, but then the narrative ends. So yeah, that is a critique. That's a really completely valid critique of Shadow of the Colossus. At the point where she is resurrected and she would be in every other story, then the protagonist of a new and interesting tale. She's got basically this adopted weirdo horn baby. She's living in a land where nobody else lives and there's not much to eat except fruit and lizard tails. How's she going to survive? How'd that horse climb the steps? Whatever.
Yeah.
You know, there's a bunch of interesting questions that are left unresolved at the end of the story, and I want to know the end of that. And that's what fanfic is for. But
sure, yeah.
But, you know, so I do really like the way that the game takes the reversal of, you know, you're actually the bad guy narrative and then interrogates it a little bit. The story, usually when you see a narrative of you're actually the bad guy, you're doing the bad thing, keep doing the bad thing, there's no consequences for that. At the end of this story, the protagonist dies horribly, literally turns into a creepy, shadow-dripping monster, and then has to basically be put down. Or is effectively, you know, kind of, I haven't replayed the game completely, but is effectively destroyed by his choices and suffers for it, which at least seems to me to be a little bit of moral realism. You know, you're the bad guy, you're suffering for it, that at least feels like you're not rewarded for doing these awful things. So, I mean, I'm able to work with it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm just had a conversation I literally can't remember what I did an hour ago.
Oh, no.
Because this is reminding me.
Because we're on a boat.
Exactly. You have no memory. But when you step on the boat and your memory is gone completely. Mm. But no, I was just having this conversation. And I feel like it was in one of the interviews I was doing here. So sorry, listeners.
That's
you're going to hear this again.
Uh-huh.
But that you will do an activity or like you'll play a game or you'll watch a movie or whatever it is. And you're the... Oh, I remember. Okay. Sorry.
Okay.
We were talking about The Little Rascals.
Oh.
And the He-Man woman hater club or whatever.
Right.
And so you spend the whole movie, the remake movie.
I don't think I ever saw the movie. I just used to watch a TV show as a kid. Yeah.
But so I think what I was told today is that, you know, you spend the whole movie being like, He-Man, woman hater, woman hater, woman hater, woman hater. And at the very end, it's a woman that wins the tournament or whatever it is.
Or
it's a girl that wins a tournament. So it's supposed to make you be like, oh, we shouldn't hate women. But to me, and I've seen this is in games, this is in Braid, this is in all kinds of stuff like that, where...
You've been rewarded for being a woman hater the entire movie, and then at the end...
And even, it can be more subtle than that. It doesn't have, that was just the example that we had been talking about earlier, but I don't have as much forgiveness, or I don't have as much leeway for that stuff, because I feel like you spend... the entire time, like, living the status quo of what you society's already telling you to behave or think or feel. And at the end, it's like, gotcha. But that doesn't
seem enough of a reversal.
Yeah. I feel like sometimes games do that. And because games need to be quote unquote fun, and I say fun in enjoyable, satisfying, rewarding, that like having you do this whole thing and then be like, yeah, but at the end, you're a monster. Like, I'm also, this is not an equivalence, but the other game that comes to mind is Spec Ops The Line.
I never read that one. I mean, I played that one.
Yeah, it's it's another one that was like a first-person shooter that was trying to comment on violence by making you do violence.
It's a first-person shooter, though.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
So, like, yeah, there are things in there that are trying to make it harder and blah, whatever. But at the end of the day, it failed to me.
Right.
From my perspective, it failed at doing that because the thing about games is I don't think you can critique violence by doing violence.
Yeah.
Especially in this context and especially in the interactivity of it.
Right.
So, like,
there's something like a no-kill mode or something built into the game.
Sure.
Which I don't know if that game had that.
No,
it did not.
Okay. But that's the thing about, like, so what I find so special about video games is that it is a different type of storytelling.
Yeah.
And the things that we can do with it are unique.
Potentially limitless, and yet the gaming field is as locked into the tried and true way of doing things as the fantasy genre has been.
Exactly. Yeah. Look at us all around full circle here.
And so segue. What I'm seeing is the industry is evolving and beginning to try and finally engage with this in a complex way. There's another good narrative game that I've been playing, and which Tanya's probably also raved at you about, which was Mafia 3. Mafia games up to here now were so not my interest. Stealth games were not my interest. Nothing about this game was anything I was remotely interested in. But the protagonist is a black man, and the story is set in Jim Crow, fake New Orleans, in the Deep South. And the story ends up, it's a story about a terrible person doing terrible things. There is no attempt to say, don't do it with violence. There is no, I think there is some kind of like less violent mode where you punch people instead of stabbing them. But yeah, it was just, it's
I
like,
love that it's like, you might not kill them, but you're going to beat the shit out of them.
Yeah, you probably give them, like, concussions, and they may feel like they died or something, or they may die. One of the things that makes the narrative really work for me is the fact that there is an immediate acknowledgement that this person is fucked up. This is a guy who grew up basically on the streets, got adopted by a small-time black mafia family. Not mafia, but, well, yeah, they were part of the mafia. Small-time black mafia family, and then went off to Vietnam, where he became a much better and more horrific killer. And he talks about, he's got flashbacks. He talks about some of the stuff he went through and how it's kind of damaged him. You see how it damaged him over the course of the story. Of course, terrible things happen. He goes on a roaring rampage of revenge. All of his very useful murder skills from Vietnam come to the fore. He ends up being able to resolve this terrible thing that happened to him. But at the same time, what you're seeing is that he had no real other option option simply because of the circumstances he happened to be born into. He is, as a character with really only one effective skill and very few options available to him legitimately because he's living in Jim Crow, the American South. The rest of the game is concerned with showing you the context in which he lives. So one of the mafia families that he's waging war against is a family of Italian, well, at some point they were immigrants, a family of Italians who are aspirationally white. They are not considered white or treated as white in the Deep South in the 60s, but they're trying to become acceptably white. And so they do a lot of really fucked up things because they're trying to earn real whiteness, which is, you know, kind of a thing that you've seen almost every immigrant group other than black people do in the United States. You come here and you prove that you're at least not like those black people over there. And you earn your whiteness if you can, if you're pale enough. You earn your whiteness by basically reenacting the principles of white supremacy. I mean, you see that this family has done this, and that is what has caused this guy's the protagonist. That is what has caused the protagonist to be in the position he's in. And you see that this family is stuck in their position too. They can't do it any other way. And meanwhile, you've got another old Southern white family that are kind of pushing and manipulating everybody because that is how they keep on top, is by pitting this group against that group, crabs in a barrel, you know, whatever. So it's like a really interesting examination of American race relations and history.
I'm listening to you talk about this, and I don't remember. I just knowing video, like I know the game, mm-hmm. and knowing video games, mm-hmm. I feel like your reading of it is so much more interesting than the game probably is, and so much more generous than the game probably is. But
that's possible.
Yeah, I'm like because I'm listening to you explain it, and I'm like, okay, I can see these pieces, but I also know how limited game narratives are, and there's very much like, I get it is a shooter, like it has to figure out how to justify the use of violence.
It's a stealth game primarily. Okay. You can do it as a shooter. You're not going to last long, but you know you can do it as a shooter.
Sure. That's fair.
Shooter. Yeah. We'll call it that.
Yeah. So yeah, there is still very much the, like, to me, I'm like, I can still picture the game and I can still see what it's trying to do, and that like I'm like, well, the story you're telling sounds very interesting. I don't know if I would enjoy playing the game. But I'm also...
That story is there, but you...
No, I believe you.
What's happening with this, and this is a thing that is a critique of the game, none of this is made explicit. You need to understand how race works in the United States to understand just how deep they're getting with that.
Sure. And you can't assume that the player does.
Precisely.
And also there is the question in these kinds of games of how much do you need to read or explore the world to get these stories, mm-hmm. which are mm-hmm. probably not the surface stuff that you're getting off the bat. Not probably, but I assume that some of it comes out in...
Some of it you blunder into if you explore the world. Some of it is part of the narrative, though.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is too subtle for the casual player. Well, I don't want to call it the casual player, though, because I know that means a different thing in gaming. It should not.
Yeah, no. I was going to say, in this case, it could...
Right.
It could subvert that a little bit because you could casually be playing a hardcore quote-unquote game, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to get into all of the casual versus whatever. But what I mean is it reminds me of like how children's movies have developed this additional layer of complexity because the people who make children's movies have begun to realize that the parents need to get something out of it too.
Yeah.
And so there's stuff that's going to go over the kids' heads because the kids aren't sophisticated enough to get it yet. And the parents will get it. That is what is happening in that game. So,
except that's not a children parent thing.
It shouldn't be.
It's
I mean,
I want to be like a white person, not white person thing, but it's just that people who are aware of the more complicated history versus people who aren't.
Well, I mean, I think the game is acknowledging or aware of the fact, you know, these stats that we talked about at the beginning, how, you know, a good number of players are over 35, a good number of players are people of color. no one's going to make a game for us yet, sadly, you know, for just brown people over 35.
Sure. But, or at least not a AAA game.
Well, no. But they, what they can start to do, and what I think is starting to happen in this game, and maybe I'm being too generous in projecting that that's happening, but what I think is starting to develop is that the players are starting to, no, I'm sorry, the writers maybe are starting to add layers, or in this case they did add layers that some people were going to get, and a lot of other people were just going to be like, oh, it's a great shooter slash stealth game.
Yeah, yeah.
And for those people who aren't getting it yet, at least if nothing else, it's a realistic exposure to what 1960s Deep South, you know, New Orleans, whatever, was like.
Yeah.
My 74-year-old father, who grew up in Jim Crow Birmingham during the era of Bull Connor and all that, actually tried to play this game. My father does not touch video games. He's watched me play them. He was fascinated by this, and he was like, yeah, this is just like it. Oh, that we had a store on our corner that looked just like
really?
That. And, you know, when you go into the store and the manager follows the black character around the store, Dad was like, look, it was just like that. And, you know, so there's enough realism there that once you start to get it, later on, I'm hoping that later on those players who didn't pick up on it on the first time, same as those kids who missed the adult layer of humor in those kids' movies, will at some point come back and think about this game and suddenly understand a little bit more.
Yeah.
But that's, maybe that's projecting.
Yeah.
Maybe
no,
so.
That's cool. Hmm. It's making me want to play the game even though I probably would hate it. Talking with you is such a delight.
Oh, thank you.
One of my favorite parts of this entire cruise was the very rapid fire green room conversation you and I had about the Black Panther soundtrack.
Oh my God.
Which we
drunk.
Didn't get to finish
right,
because
okay.
I had to leave so quickly.
And
but...
I was drunk.
Oh, were you really?
Yeah, I don't know if you knew, but
I didn't at all.
Yeah,
you
I just had
exactly
a margarita on an empty stomach. I was, I can't hold my liquor for shit. So yeah,
it was. We both are super into the soundtrack.
I'm loving the soundtrack.
Yeah, and it was really nice to chat with you.
There's some aspects of the soundtrack that I'm still trying to really fully engage with. You know, there's a couple of songs that again I may be projecting meaning onto. You know, there's a few on there. I'm trying to remember the name of the thing. But there's one on there where the characters are talking about how, you know, they're wearing a Rolls Royce on their wrist, you know, basically a really expensive watch. They've gone out and they've sold some drugs and they beat up some guy's wife and da-da-da-da-da-da. And then, but then at the beginning of the song, they're like, you know, I'm blacking it up, basically. They're painting on a roll. They're taking on a roll. That's how I interpreted it. They're taking on a roll, and this is the role that you expect to hear from us, and that's what's really you know, that's not what's really happening here, but that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to enact these roles because this is what you expect. But then there's a subtext of language there that tells me there's a lot more conscious and a lot more elaborate engagement with, but this is fucked up. But this is what America kind of constantly expects of us and pushes us towards. But this is what it means to live in a toxic, patriarchal, masculinity, racist state. I may be projecting things onto it. I may also be punchy because I've been using the soundtrack to kind of cover up my roommate snoring. So I've been listening to the soundtrack as I go to sleep, and it's like starting to penetrate my like dream brain, and I don't know what's happening now.
Well, because when we were having this conversation, so I'm really bad at hearing lyrics, and if I'm going to hear lyrics to a song, I actually look them up and like sit down and study it with the music because I can't just
Well, this is actually rapid fire. Really, like they're switching dialects multiple times.
Yeah,
it's hard to understand the lyrics in this case.
Yeah,
and so that's consciously done. I think.
We don't have internet on the boat, and so that conversation that you and I had, I was like, was it this? Was it that? But maybe it was this, and we kept trying to be like, no, we can't look it up right now.
Well,
and
I mean,
I feel like if we had internet, we would have been in that room for like 2 hours.
Oh, I paid for the package. So I did actually look up a couple of things. Yeah, like I was having trouble understanding the chorus of All the Stars. So at the time, all I heard was All the Stars Are.
Yeah.
You know, that was it. That was, I couldn't tell what the first few lines were. And what she's actually singing is, oh shit, I've completely forgotten it. But basically, she's saying, maybe my dreams will let me finally understand that all the stars are closer. She's talking about sort of the what I'm interpreting it as is that she's the song is engaging with the fact that a lot of Black people have just dreamed for years of possibility, and the possibilities were always a little limited. The things that we were told to reach for were like literally as far away as the stars. I mean, just being able to imagine different possibilities brings the stars closer.
That's so great.
Oh, God.
I love that.
She looks like she's going to cry right now. Okay.
I'm like, that's so sweet.
That's my interpretation of it.
I'll take it.
But I mean,
I like your interpretations.
Well, but then that is what people are getting out of Black Panther. You know, and this is the thing that I read a short story as part of my thing here on the cruise. Where I was talking about the fact that I was having difficulty just trying to imagine a world without racism.
Yeah.
And how difficult it is even to try and just conjure that up in my head. And I'm supposed to be the person who does these things for a living.
I've tried to do this with patriarchy too, and it's really fucking hard.
It's because that's all we know.
It's all we know.
And without even the language to describe certain things.
Like, the way this room is designed could be different.
Yeah.
Like, it's that deep.
It's that deep. A simple little change, a small change in any society is going to enact massive changes on a macro scale. So as I try to just imagine this, and I struggle to imagine it, along comes Black Panther, where I see somebody else's projection of what a society like that might be like. Now, I don't know the details. I have no idea how Wakanda actually operates. I don't understand what their economy is like. I don't know how they've managed to stay hidden.
They definitely have a magic economy.
Yeah, there's a lot of like, there's a lot of just like, you know, just
we've
accept
got
it.
Everything, And I'm just, like, yes, I will accept it. I will be right here
just,
with you.
you know, you don't need to know those things. Yeah. Those things. But at the same time, simply having that visual image, seeing architecture that isn't derived from or doesn't primarily derive from kind of European styles and standards. You didn't see any modernism or brutalism or any of that kind of stuff in the way that those buildings were built. In fact, some of those buildings were, pulling from the science fiction tradition of solar punk. They were, basically carpeted in plants and things like that, possibly as an energy-saving measure, possibly as a alternative energy economy. We don't know what the hell is going on there, but we love the look of it. And you can look at this and you can just simply watch this movie and your ability to perceive what might be changes. The stars are closer. That was my interpretation.
Yeah.
So
I really love how much you really put a lot of care and thought into the way that you look at media and the way that you look at things. Like, you know, I'm like, the music sounds
how my
cool.
Brain works.
Yeah.
The music sounds cool. The music sounds cool too.
Yeah. No, I definitely, I obviously have a more sophisticated analysis than that, but I very much enjoy chatting with you because I feel like it's so thoughtful and it's so energetic, and you really back up your perspectives and you like in this way, I don't know, whatever. I enjoy this. So thank you is what I'm trying to say.
Thank you.
If folks want to find you or learn more about you or find your books or would you like to plug something is what I'm getting at.
You can find summaries and samples of all of my books on my website, which is nkjemisin.com. That's nkjemisin.com. You can find me on Twitter as NK Jemisin. I'm on Tumblr. I'm not on Tumblr as much as I used to be, or really as I probably should be. I'm on Facebook, but I barely kind of do anything there except yell at people. I mostly yell at people on Tumblr too and Twitter. Actually, there's a pattern. So you can find and engage with me there. That's perfectly fine. I do have a pretty heavy block list on Twitter, so a lot of people are just preemptively blocked if they have...
As one should do.
Yes. So it's not personal. It's my auto-blocker. But that said, you can find me there. And my books are in bookstores, libraries, whatever.
So. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was fun.